Welcome to Soundboard, the Steinway & Sons podcast. I'm your host, Ben Finan, editor-in-chief of Listen, Life with Music and Culture, a print quarterly published by Steinway & Sons. Visit steinway.com/listen to subscribe or learn more. My guest today is the Steinway artist Paul Lewis, who has been spending a lot of time with Ludwig van Beethoven and Franz Schubert. Lewis has a recording of the complete Beethoven piano sonatas on Harmonia Mundi, and recently completed a two-year project of recording all of Schubert's mature piano works. He spoke to me from Steinway's global headquarters in New York City. You played cello initially.
Yeah.
How long did you play the cello before you made the switch?
Too long.
It wasn't for you.
No, well, I love the cello. It's just, it was hard to love when I was actually playing it. That's the point, really. I started when I was 8 with cello lessons and went on with that till I was 14, but made very little progress.
Okay. When you switched to piano, did you find, in retrospect, that cello playing was helpful in any way?
It's hard to know, really. Thinking back, I'm not sure whether I did. I don't want to labor the point, but I was such a bad cellist that I hope nothing stuck from that, really. But I mean, obviously now, when you play, and of course, when you play chamber music, especially, you try to imitate the sounds of string instruments and all of that. You know, you try to incorporate as much of that in your playing as you can. But I think that's just something I do now rather than something that was an influence from back then. I mean, I was literally scraping away. It was dreadful.
I took violin lessons for 2 days when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And it was just playing an open A, and I couldn't handle it. I knew that it wasn't the right sound. I mean, what's great about the piano is like that's...
You push it.
That's in tune, you know, or at least the tuning has nothing to do with you.
Yeah.
It's just under the fingers.
Unless you bash it so hard that you put it out of tune.
When you did your Beethoven project and your Schubert projects, this was, what, 10 years underwater with Beethoven. Is there some emotional strain that comes with that?
The first time I did a series or a cycle of any kind was 2001-2002 season, and that was the Schubert sonatas, the completed sonatas, plus the reliquary. That was my first adventure with that sort of project. And what really struck me was that it was like having a personal relationship in a way. Sometimes it's incredibly rewarding and enlightening, and other times it's a struggle. And you know, you have the high, you take the highs with the lows. And I guess that's because it's incredibly emotional music. You know, it's hard not to be that involved with it when you're immersed in it. You know, when you're exclusively dealing with it all the time. So it becomes very personal and very emotional. It's at the same time, I think it's good to try to keep a distance from that, you know, save it for the concerts. Not sure it should be the sort of thing that follows you around in your daily life.
You don't need to be in character all day.
No, hopefully not. Yeah. No.
Going through all of the Beethoven sonatas, what discoveries did you make?
I think, you know what, because I did the Schubert series first, and then Beethoven Sonata series was a few years later, I noticed the difference between these two composers. One of the main the differences became more pronounced the more I played them. And one of the main differences for me is that Beethoven always has an answer, whereas Schubert almost never does. And Schubert is this overriding sense of irresolution, you know, that there's no resolution, that there's just a sort of open-ended...
As opposed to the triumph of Beethoven.
Which is, you know, resolution, triumph in the middle period. Later on it became almost like a sense of just rising above everything. You know, this feeling that you get in 111, and it's but in some way Beethoven resolves. You know, he has an answer, and I don't know. It's interesting to speculate what that tells you about the personalities of those two composers.
But it's interesting to think about too about this idea of transcendence that he achieves, maybe after so much work with the form, of in a way transcending that form. I mean, those sonatas at the end, it's a very liberal structure that we don't see earlier.
In Beethoven.
In Beethoven's sonatas.
Yeah, it certainly develops in its own unique way later on. As is the case with Schubert, I mean, Schubert, a lot of people say that Schubert struggled with the form as well. I'm not entirely sure he did. I think you could argue that if you compare it directly to Beethoven, because it's not like Beethoven. I think later on in the later Schubert sonatas, you just have this incredible sense of space, whereas Beethoven often develops at high speed. You know, everything is dense and very busy in the way it develops, and it almost never is with Schubert. I don't think that's a fault. It's just an attribute. It's just a characteristic of his music, really, which I think often it that's the way it's structured. It needs that space to speak.
And you give it that space, and I was struck re-listening to your Beethoven sonatas. I was struck by this, by the legato and by the rubato and by the space that you give it. I mean, a lot of your movements are certainly not weren't geared toward shock and awe. There was a real reflection. Pathetique just this morning, and real space and time that you give it, not this need to sort of fly through.
I think we were saying about balance in Schumann before, same is true with Beethoven, because, you know, Beethoven can traditionally be seen as this tempestuous, boisterous, outspoken, unwashed character, you know, sort of comes through in his music, and that is there for sure, but there's a balance again. You know, there's also great tenderness and space and time in there. I think it's just, you know, when you spend years with this music, I guess you go through life seeing the balance differently every time you come back to it. But that's what I try to find. I mean, for instance, the last movement, the Pathetique,
yes,
is. Maybe my tempo on the recording is slightly slower than some other people. I see it as that there's a little bit of melancholy in there. There's a little bit of nostalgia. At least that's how I hear it.
Nostalgia even for the opening movement.
Yeah. For the drive and for the self-assurance of that opening movement. The last movement seems to be just a little more reflective.
Now, also in that movement, and then sometimes in these sonatas as a whole, I'm sort of reminded how Beethoven is always symphonic, even when he's writing for the piano. Even, you know, in the last movement of the Pathetique, this you could see it being passed and forth, back and forth among an orchestra. How do you take that into account if you're sort of, I mean, do you try to establish a symphonic sound from the keyboard or?
Absolutely, yeah. I think all the time. The greatest piano music requires you to think in terms of anything other than piano sound.
That's interesting.
Most of the time. I think, because you know that's the great thing about the piano. It can be many things. Mm-hmm. If it's just a piano, it's a very pure piano sound. I find it less interesting somehow. Mm-hmm. I think music that pushes you to think in terms of an orchestra, or the more specific sounds of maybe chamber music, like slow movement of Opus 2, number 2, mm-hmm. could be a string quartet easily. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you could easily transcribe that, and vocal as well. The second movement, the last movement of Opus 90, which has a slightly Schubertian feel to it, and you could imagine that some, you know, there's something vocal about that. And I think you have to be thinking constantly in these terms.
Do you stay conscious? I would ask, like, even to the point of, am I on a bass string right now? Are you sort of conscious of your orchestra in front of you?
Yeah. I mean, to the point, even, you know, when you play with rubato, for instance, I find it, especially in music where you might be thinking orchestrally, the rubato that you play with, I always ask myself the question, if I were conducting an orchestra, could I indicate exactly how this rubato works? You know, logically.
Holding yourself responsible for the through line, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Would an orchestra be able to understand this rubato from my gestures? Could I indicate that? Because if you can't, then I think it falls into a very free, more pianistic territory. You know? You know what I mean?
It's self-indulgent, really, could be a word, like,
yeah,
right? Let's go to the Schubert. Now, you put together a project of, to put it not so eloquently, that sort of post-syphilis Schubert.
Yeah.
The 1820 to 28. And did you find what you thought you were going to find, which is to say, can we tell that Schubert knows he's on his way out? You have Schubert's life, then you have Schubert's music. How much of each is informing our knowledge of the other?
Well, a lot has been discussed about, you know, Schubert and his illness and whether he knew that he was on his way out. And what we do know is that he had this diagnosis at the beginning of 1823. Mm-hmm. The next, in terms of the piano sonatas, the next piece that was written was Deutsch 784, the A minor. Mm-hmm. There's nothing in his music that sets up what that language becomes there, you know, what there's no precedent for that sense of austerity and sparseness and hopelessness and terror even. It's something completely new. So it's hard not to link the two events. It's not, I don't imagine that he suddenly thought he was just going to die there, you know. I think the point is that he suddenly had an acute awareness of his own mortality, you know, as a young man, still in his 20s. Most people tend not to think about that when they're in their mid-20s, really. Mm-hmm. At least, well, I didn't.
I didn't.
I'm going to speak for everyone here. But I think it's that awareness, the fact that his musical language changed so abruptly, and is
so you can detect a shift of a change in language.
There's a change of something.
Okay.
And most of what he wrote after that period, after that time, seems a lot more interesting than some of the things that came before. I'm not trying to, you know, say that. I mean, there are many great pieces that he wrote before that, but in general, there's a depth and a darkness and a ambiguousness that comes into the later period.
At the least, we can say that his condition sped up his road to maturity.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, practically overnight, as it seems.
Where do you go from here? Now having this knowledge of these two composers. Is this a pattern that you want to continue as far as delving deep into from one composer one over to the next?
Yeah, I like to do it like that, but I don't want to do that all the time. I think it's probably healthy to give yourself some time, some in the years in between these big projects to mix it up and to play a variety of other things, because there's such a lot of great music to play, because, you know, that doesn't want to miss out on it. So at the moment it's Mussorgsky, Pictures and Exhibition, and yeah. Bach, Busoni, Chorale Preludes, and some Liszt, and, you know, Brahms D minor concerto. It's all a different bag of things, really.
I imagine it also helps to not constantly be playing solo piano, to have a balance of playing with others, whether it's chamber music or concertos. Or
yeah.
Does that give you a healthier...
It does. Because it's
bring some teamwork in, or
yeah, because concerto playing is different from recital playing, and concerto and recital is different from chamber music. You know, it's a different discipline, really. It's a different way of listening and different way of approaching, of blending and trying to play the right part. Uh-huh. I guess. See, I don't play that much chamber music, really, but when I do, it's just so hard. It's the hardest thing you can do.
Because of trying to... Why is it so difficult?
You know what it is? Mm. You play chamber music. You play from the score, traditionally.
Right.
I don't like playing from the score. And yet in chamber music, when everyone else is playing from the score, I don't have the confidence not to play from the score.
Mm. You feel more tied to the, to
yeah.
the notation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Whereas, because I'm more used to playing recitals or concertos, and that's from memory,
yeah.
It's just what I'm used to. It just feels more free somehow. Mm-hmm. I think it's a silly reason, but it's kind of...
yeah, but I can understand that, because once you memorize a piece, then you're not tethered in that way.
Yeah.
And also, you're at that point... I mean, that's really where the musicianship starts, right? After the notes and the technique are learned,
yeah.
then you're making artistic choices and decisions.
Yeah.
Whereas if I have to always, you know, be counting rests to come in,
yeah,
maybe it's harder to reach that next level.
Yeah,
with the music in front of you.
I think so, because I think a question of trust, how much you trust yourself, also comes into it. Because when you're in a situation where you're playing from memory, you have to trust yourself. There's no choice. You have the music there. Well, okay, do you trust yourself? Or, well, I mean, if you have a memory lapse with the music there, then you're going to feel a bit silly, aren't you? So
yeah.
So do you look at the music? It's more of a...
Is it a crutch? Or,
yeah, it's more of a distraction. It can be, at least. You know.
Pictures in an exhibition, it seems to be always, and it's a bit of a cliche, but it's always one of those pieces that could have been written yesterday.
Yeah.
I mean, just an eternally modern, like, I feel that with Sibelius Fifth, I feel it with a few other pieces, but this one particularly, I think in the, maybe it comes from the richness of color in the piece, but
I think is that absolutely right, because for me it's one of the most staggeringly original pieces ever written.
Yeah.
I mean, when I think about it, in the last one, The Great Gate of Kiev, you get these passages which are clearly like Russian church music.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously Mussorgsky didn't come up with that himself. You know, that's something that's kind of inspired. But the rest of it, there's almost, I can think of no precedent for
right.
what he writes. You know, it's pure... It's totally
invention.
Original invention.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's so radical, and in some cases, so brutal and shocking that I think it that's how it has to sound. It has to sound contemporary.
There is that's. Really, you put your finger on something. The brutality of that piece.
Yeah.
It does. It, there's not, we don't know where that comes from.
No.
Or you can't trace that in a continuum through the years.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he doesn't compromise. He doesn't make it easy for the listener. And the one thing that there's very little of in that piece is warmth. You know, it's not that kind of... there's at no point do you feel it really hugs you, you know?
Even the promenade theme is a bit metallic.
Yeah, there's a feeling of relentlessness about it.
Uh-huh.
And this, and the meter, which of course he rightly changes between 5 and 6 and occasionally 7.
Yeah, always unsteady.
Yeah, so it gives you that sense of, I suppose, of constant movement. There's no reference there.
Mm-hmm.
Always on the move.
Eating its tail.
Yeah, that in itself is radical, you know, just an idea.
Well, hey, thanks for talking to me.
Is that all right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Great.
I really appreciate it. You've been listening to Soundboard, the Steinway & Sons podcast. Visit steinway.com/soundboard to learn more. We heard Paul Lewis playing Beethoven's Pathetique Sonata No. 8 in C minor, Opus 13, and Schubert's Grand Sonata No. 14 in A minor, Deutsch 784, both on Harmonia Mundi. Ravel's orchestration of Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition was performed by Fritz Reiner and the Chicago Symphony Orchestra on RCA. Following the interview, Paul Lewis's take on Pictures at an Exhibition was released on Harmonia Mundi. Our intro and outro music is Mad Rush by Philip Glass, performed live on a Steinway Model M by me, Ben Finan, editor-in-chief of Listen, Life with Music and Culture. Visit steinway.com/listen to learn more.